You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast featuring some of Indiana's most fascinating men and women whose impact has shaped our state, our communities, and us. Join us as we discuss their imprint on our history. Leaders and Legends is brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated, your local veteran business enterprise specializing in public relations, media relations, public outreach, crisis communications, and digital photography. My name is Robert Bain, Principal of Veteran Strategies, former Deputy Chief of Staff to Mayor Greg Ballard, and Communications Director for the Indiana Republican Party. I'm honored to be your host for our discussion. We are here and joined by Mark Allen, legendary local journalist and world-renowned Seinfeld expert. We plan to talk a lot about music and Seinfeld and Mark's background and how he came to Indianapolis and all things Indianapolis culture. He currently works at Butler University, and we couldn't be more pleased. Thank you, sir.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
So the Mount Rushmore of Seinfeld episodes. If you had to choose four, I'm not dicking around. We're getting right to the heart of the matter.
Okay, we're going right to it. The opposite.
The opposite.
The pool guy. Let's see. You started off strong there.
You don't bury the lead on this show, Mark. Don't you know that?
Yeah. Let me think. We'll come back to it.
But okay. So let me think if I could be helpful.
Yeah,
here.
See if you can be helpful.
Fusilli Jerry is my favorite episode because it's putty. Actually, the dealership would be another putty episode.
I know you love the dealership. It's okay, but it's. I don't think it's in the Mount Rushmore.
That's the burning, which is another putty episode. Yep. That's got the great one where he believes in God and Elaine can't handle it. Dumb and stupid, I understand, or whatever it is. And then my sleeper episode would be the Andrea Doria.
The Andrea Doria is a great episode. That belongs in there too. Yeah.
What about like the puffy shirt?
Puffy shirt's a good one. I mean, they hit their rhythm, what, about 6-7 shows in, and they kept it going pretty close to the end. The last season's a little rough, but what am I thinking of here? Okay, so the Festivus episode, the strike, that's it, and the Merv Griffin show. That's one of my other favorite ones.
The Rye,
yes, the Marble Rye is great.
So, what made you? Now, you're originally from New York City, is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
And so, was Seinfeld familiar to you because of that, or you just loved the characters? What made you? My kids are gigantic Seinfeld freaks, and that's just. I like to think good parenting. Once my son Andrew and my daughter Anna met Mark at a restaurant so we could play Clue Seinfeld.
That's right.
And
Andrew won.
Andrew did win. Your daughter was there, as I recall.
That's right.
Both of our daughters were mortified that we're playing Clue Seinfeld in a public spot where people could see us.
Well, and Andrew introduced himself to me. He said, "Hi, my name is Andrew. I'm unemployed and I live with my parents."
He did. And then I remember once on your birthday, I had my daughter text you, "Happy birthday, Mark. Drop dead."
That's right. That's right.
What about the show? I mean, it's certainly a top five comedy of all time, you'd have to say. Yeah. Seminal 90s show. You're from New York City. What about the show turned you on, and besides just the general fact that it's extremely well written and creative?
It's just so silly, maybe. It's I never liked Seinfeld the comedian. I don't think he's funny, and when he would come on a talk show, I would turn the talk show off. And I didn't watch Seinfeld for I think 3 or 4 seasons. And Steve Hall, who was my predecessor as the TV critic at the Star, said, "You got to watch this show." And I'm like, "No, I don't want to watch Seinfeld." But anyway, we were supposed to be out one night, and this was when Seinfeld was on Wednesday nights. And we came home early. It was on, and we watched it and thought, "Wow, this is really funny. I really miss this."
Do you remember which episode?
Started watching. I don't, but it was great. I mean, it was probably something where they were writing the Jerry sitcom, it feels like. But I could be wrong about that.
Who's your favorite non-main character?
Are you talking about like somebody who had a recurring role or somebody who just was on once?
Recurring role. I mean, because if it's just on once, then that's obviously Marissa Tomei. Like, we get that.
Well, Marissa, yeah. She does, I think I've told you, I met her, mm-hmm. and I asked her, do you really like short, stocky, bald men? And she was great. I mean, she laughed and she just went, that will forever remain a mystery. Great, great line. But, the recurring characters, I mean.
Obviously, other than.
Putty's great.
Mm-hmm. Putty over Frank Costanza?
Frank's pretty wild. Did you ever see the episode where it's not Jerry Stiller?
Yeah, it's Frank, I forget the name of the guy, but there's a great outtake, or not an outtake, a documentary part of that where they wanted Frank Costanza to basically be, craven and put upon and basically bullied by Estelle, and that Jerry Stiller, when he was doing the part, just decided one time to just start screaming back at her, and Larry David immediately goes, "That's it.
Yep.
Yes, that's it."
Newman, the show doesn't. I love Newman.
And you have a Newman story. Go ahead,
Newman
tell it.
Story. So I met Wayne Knight, and I said, "Where is the most unusual place that you were? Hello, Newman." And he said, "In the Vatican." And he was, forgive me because I don't remember the details of it, but he's walking up some staircase, and he's feeling, he's kind of alone with his thoughts, and mm-hmm. somebody comes up to him and says, "Hello, Newman." And that's just, I love it. I had a lot of, because I was a TV critic at the paper, and I used to go out to California once a year or sometimes twice, I would meet a lot of people who had recurring roles or one-time roles in Seinfeld, and it was just really fun because those people, my favorite one was, I'm blanking on the actress's name, and she's married to, boy, my memory is not what it used to be. But anyway, she played.
Well, you didn't grow
Lisi.
Up in the 70s, Mark.
I grew up in the 60s. she played Lisi on the episode where the sentence finisher.
Right.
Remember her? So, right. And her name is Julia Campbell. Yes, now I'm remembering it. And so I was talking to her husband, whose name is Jay Carnes, and he was one of the characters on The Shield. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever watched that, but he played Dutch on The Shield. And so we're having a nice chat, and his wife comes up, and so he introduces me, and I said, and I just blurt out, and I go, "You played Lisi on Seinfeld." And they're both looking at me like, "Uh-oh, this guy's insane," because like they don't remember the character's name, and I do.
And so, you read that a lot in magazines, whether it's rock stars or TV or movie stars, where they'll come up and say, "Hey, you remember so-and-so? And there's a great story when Eddie Van Halen met Tommy Iommi from Black Sabbath.
Tony,
that's what I thought. Forgive me. Yeah. I misspoke. And Van Halen's first tour, they were on with Black Sabbath. And Van Halen goes up to him and starts saying, "You remember this song on this side of this album and you played it this way?" And Ami was like, "I have no idea what you're talking about. Yeah. Like, you're kidding me, right?" And that then Van Halen said later on, when he got famous, people would do that to him. And he's like, "I played what? On what side of what album? I don't know what you mean." Yeah. So the fact that those of us who are fans go up to stars and people, I'm like, "You remember that one time?" And they're like, "You know what? I've done 400 episodes of that show. I don't have any idea what you're talking about."
Well, it's like that famous Shatner bit, right? About, it was just a job. Get over it.
Oh,
right?
The Saturday Night Live skit?
Yes. But
have any of you even kissed a girl?
Right, exactly. But I mean, and that's true. Like, I met Jason Alexander, and he was just putting out this show called Bob Patterson, which is the first thing he did after Seinfeld. And there were at least five clear Seinfeld references in the first episode of Bob Patterson. So I mentioned that to him, and he's looking at me, and he's giving me the stink eye. I think mm-hmm. it was the stink eye, but he's looking at me, and he can't think of the references. And then I saw him later that same day, and I said, you know, you were giving me this funny look, and he said, just because I can't remember the moments that you're talking about. And that's it. You know, for them, for a lot of them, it's a job.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's what you forget, right? It's like they don't live it the way we live it as fans.
And they probably don't see the same episode.
Right. They're not going to watch the same episode
15 to 20 times. Yes. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've seen like Festivus. Well, my kids and I watch it every year on December 23rd for the past 12 years.
Right.
That's just 12 times. You have another, as I recall, Seinfeld cast encounter, if you want to share that.
Let's see, which one?
I believe she signed something for you.
She signed something for me. Could you be a little more specific?
She had an unfortunate encounter with some stamps or envelopes, excuse me.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I have Heidi Swedberg's autograph. So Heidi Swedberg, who played Susan, and I didn't meet her, but my sister, who was working for an artist manager out in L.A., and they handled her. And so she came up to, she was up in the offices, and my sister said, my brother's a big Seinfeld fan. Well, would you mind signing this? And would you sign it? You can stuff your sorries in a sack, mister. And Heidi Swedberg looked at my sister and said, why would I do that? And she said, because you said it on the show. And Heidi Swedberg said, I did. And, you know, it's just these things mean way more to us than they do to the actors, you know.
You mentioned growing up in New York City. Talk a little bit how you ended up in Indianapolis, because I do want to ask you some questions about growing up in New York City, the sure. big city in the world, especially at the time.
Yeah.
How did you end up here?
For a job. So basically, you know, I was a newspaper reporter, and back in the day, you would start at a small paper. So I started in Massachusetts at a small paper. And then I moved to Pennsylvania to another paper, you know, slightly bigger. And you just, the idea is to keep moving up in circulation and ideally in salary. So, but circulation was really the most important thing. So I was in grad school, and then I got a job in New York at a paper in the, outside of New York City. And I was looking for work, and I applied to the Indianapolis Star. Basically, I would go home, and whenever I was in a bad mood, I would take out the editor and publisher yearbook, which had the listings of every newspaper in the country, and I would look at the circulation, and I would go, okay, I want to be in one of the top 100 circulation papers. So, and I would just start typing, and like 5 hours later, and I'm not exaggerating that, mm-hmm. you know, and I would send out 20 cover letters and clips and things like that. And one night, actually I had, by that point I had moved back, that I was living in Springfield, Illinois, and the city editor of the Star, Dennis Royalty, called me and said, we've got an opening. Why don't you come in and interview? And, you know, I'd only ever been through Indianapolis, and, came here for the interview on a Saturday and got the job.
What was your first, what were you hired to do when you came here?
Police reporter. So
really? So what year is this?
1988. Started January 4th, 1988.
How close is that to, was it Michael Taylor?
Michael Taylor.
I was in the military. Happened. I was gone, but.
Michael Taylor had happened, and the guy who.
People don't know, correct me if my memory fails me, but Michael Taylor was in the back of a police car, handcuffed, I believe.
Right, and
got shot
himself.
And there's a big to-do on whether he was executed or actually had a gun and committed suicide.
Right, right. Michael Taylor, it happened. Fred Sanders, I think, either.
Oh, who shot and killed was Faber?
Matt Faber. That happened shortly after I got here. The first murder that happened was about, I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks into my job. And it was a day off for me. So, you know, so I had kind of like been sitting in the police. We had an office in the police station in the city county building. And I would, you know, sit there and listen to the police scanner And, you know, when there
did you bequeath that scanner to Reichert, to Vic Reichert, when he took over?
Mr. I think there were people between us.
Vic, but, you may not be listening to this ever, but you're the king of the 10:45 in the evening phone call. Just FYI. How did you, where'd you go to college?
Emerson College in Boston.
Boston.
And then I went back to school for a master's at what was then Sangamon State University in Springfield, Illinois, and is now called the University of Illinois at Springfield.
Did you work as the police reporter long? How did you end up as the entertainment critic, TV/music?
So when I wasn't doing police and stuff on my off time, I would write for the arts sections of the Star. They had the weekend section and the Sunday section, which are both sadly gone from the paper. And so when a job came open, they created a job for just a general assignment arts writer, and they gave it to me. And
is that a job you had wanted? I mean, that you preferred to write about that?
Oh yeah. I mean, the worst concert beats the best homicide.
Point taken. Did it take you a while to get your handle on Indianapolis as an arts city coming from New York City? I mean, that's obviously especially back then, the difference was Canyon-esque. Now, maybe not so much, but back then, I mean, did you bring the Pauline Kael, New Yorker sort of attitude to flyover country?
Well, I brought probably a more critical view than most people were used to. I mean, my predecessor, Joel Warren, who's a friend of mine, you know, it was pretty easygoing on things. And I'm not, you know, if I think it stinks, I'm going to say it stinks, you know, and people were free to disagree with me, and boy, did they. I mean, I wish I had thought of it. I would have brought my, my stack of mail because, you know, back then I kept every letter anybody ever wrote me as long as it was signed. You know, and I would always open the envelope because you had to write a letter, an actual right. physical letter, and get an envelope and a stamp. And I always thought, you know, if people take the time to do that, then they deserve to be read and stuff. But I want to make sure it's signed. I don't want to read some anonymous person, you know, writing me nasty stuff. So, so I kept it, and I have a file, and it's probably, I don't know, 6-7 inches of mail. You know, some of it's positive, a lot of it's negative, and I always kept that. You know, and the typical things were, you know, there were 18,000 people there who loved it. Where concert were you at? You know, and I was at the same concert you were, but I didn't pay for it, and I wasn't there to enjoy myself. I was there to write, you know, did I think this was a good show? You know, my approach was, if I were an intelligent fan of this group, would I be happy with this performance? And that's, you know, the other people go to shows to enjoy it, and they pay their money and, you know, enjoy it. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm there to be critical of it or to explain why I think it's good or not good.
Let's get into music a little bit, sure. 'Cause that's obviously where I would see your byline in the Star. And I didn't go to many concerts, you know, because they weren't cheap, but, you know, really, I would have to say that I saved my money for Mellencamp, Rush, Van Halen. I did see Ted Nugent once, and that was an experience because I hate to say this is maybe as, I don't know the word, counterintuitive, or the sound was so loud I couldn't hear the music. Like, yeah. It was so unbelievably loud, you just really couldn't differentiate between parts of the songs.
There are shows like that. Nugent was always very, very loud. Pantera was probably the loudest show I ever saw, but that was really a good show. Eminem was another one I saw that I just was like, wow, you could turn this down halfway and it would still be blistering. And the Ramones were famous for being loud. But, you know, I mean, it's a little different seeing somebody who's loud in an arena versus loud in a club. I mean, and when I saw the Ramones, I mean, they were mostly in a theater. So
who did you see? So you say you grew up in the 60s, 70s, well, right? When did you graduate from high school?
76.
Okay. So who did you see in New York City? I mean, you're lucky enough that everyone plays New York City, yeah. right? I mean, you know, you don't always get McCartney coming through Indianapolis, even though right. next this year later it'll be in Fort Wayne. But who did you see where you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm right in front of these guys? Because I would imagine that you had a chance to see just about everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I saw, you know, like, I'm probably one of the few people who's seen Zeppelin and Nirvana, you know. but
do you feel like the concerts, you know, the 70s are known as kind of the era of arena rock and concert and these monster albums and these incredible acts. I mean, probably too many to name. Zeppelin, Who, Pink Floyd,
yeah,
later Van Halen, Fleetwood Mac, Eagles, Yes, Rush.
I'm old enough to have seen
Stones.
I saw The Who with Keith Moon, and I saw The Wall, Pink Floyd do The Wall. And that was only, the original concert was only in New York and Los Angeles and London. So that was good. And
any of those stand out in particular that you, which Zeppelin tour did you see after which album? Or how many times did you see him? Isn't it more than?
I only saw him once. Mm-hmm. And it was 1976, I think it was.
So Physical Graffiti or Presence?
I'm trying to remember. I'm thinking Houses of the Holy, actually.
Okay. So did you, was there anything about what you saw in the 70s with all these fantastic concerts that made you think, man, I want to be involved with this somehow? Like, part of me wants to be involved with playing, writing, singing, however.
I couldn't play. I was terrible. And I could sing a bit, but I couldn't maintain my voice. I had a good enough voice that I was in all-county choir when I was in ninth grade, but when I would sing for any length of time, I would lose my voice. So I did not have that kind of control. So, I mean, I wanted to write about it, and I always did write about it from the time, I mean, I was probably in high school, I would even write pretend reviews of things.
Really?
Yeah, just to try it out and see what it was like, you know, to be a critic. And then, but the thing is, like, the small papers that will hire you, they don't have a music critic. So you could write on your own time and everything. They'd be happy to have that. And so I would do that. But it wasn't until I came to the Star. The Star was the first paper I had that I went to that had a music critic.
And as a fan, you know, you decide you like this much money is worth this much entertainment, right? McCartney cost $300. That was how much I paid for my ticket, my kids' ticket. So it was a $900 night. And, you know, to me, it was worth every penny. I mean, what are the odds he ever comes back here? Yeah. My kids can talk smack in 40 years that they saw a Beatle play a Beatles song, you know, in person. And that's not a lot of people are going to be able to say that. But as a critic, and you have to go, how do you steel your mind to go, all right, I wouldn't pay $3 to go to this concert, but I've got to go as a professional. I mean, talk about that. Like, how do you do it? Go to a band or an act that you can't possibly imagine paying for and try to be judicious and objective?
Well, if I couldn't be fair, I wouldn't go. I mean, there are acts I could not be fair to. I don't
name,
you know, John Denver, Kenny G, Janet Jackson.
You just didn't find anything about their work appealing?
No. And I did review Janet Jackson once, and I just found her, I just hated it. I mean, I hated everything about it. It just seemed so fake to me.
Well, there's certainly some catchy songs. So it's just a production or?
Yeah, it was just, I mean, she cried on cue. And it was so obviously fake, and you knew that she cried at that moment at every show. And I just thought, there's nothing genuine about this. I can't watch this. And then there are just people whose music I really dislike. I mean, Janet Jackson has some fine songs. I just did not like her on stage.
Did you ever did you ever see Michael Jackson?
I never did see Michael Jackson, no. No, when he played here, it was before I was the critic, and he never played here again.
So. Were you scared that Kenny G would just be too loud? Too rough?
You know, the thing is, I did review Kenny G once, and I gave him a very good review because he did play a good show. Again, if I were a fan of that, and thank God I'm not, but if I were a fan of that, I would go, yeah, I'd be happy with that performance. I mean, he works hard at it. He gives people a broad spectrum of his music. I don't happen to like that music, but, you know, that's fine. But I can't go there and go, oh, he's really quite a musician. I mean, he's great at what he does. I just can't stand what he does.
Because your point was like, look, if people came to hear these songs played this way with this demeanor, they were happy. But if you were dragged here because you weren't necessarily a fan, then you probably walked away struggling.
Yeah, yeah. There was an old episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show where Ted does something good and Murray says to him something about, you know, when a donkey flies, you don't blame him for not staying up in the air very long. And and that's sort of, you know, my feeling. It's like, if you were, you know, I could probably watch you once, but if I really detested what you do, you know, and I can't be fair to you, I don't want to write about you. It's not fair to the fans. It's not fair to the artist.
And who did you, when they were coming through, like, okay, I can't believe I get to see this show for free and I actually get paid to watch these people, not me paying.
Well, you know, most of the time, Little Feat was my favorite band. And so, so it was always a treat. Although the last time I saw them, they weren't very good. Springsteen, you know, I grew up an enormous, enormous Springsteen fan. And, so there was that, and, you know, it was, and then there were artists like, you know, who were great in concert, whose music I don't particularly like Billy Joel, I've never been a fan of. And
really, even Billy Joel, I mean, you must have really grown up with Billy Joel there in New York City.
I grew up in Long Island, and so did Billy Joel. So he's a few years older than I am, but you know, I never grew up a fan of his music at all. But I mean, the guy puts on just one great show. You gotta love that performance. I mean, he works his tail off for the audience. And Elton John, it's the same way. I don't like Elton John particularly. And actually, the one time I saw Elton John to review him, I didn't give him a particularly positive review because I didn't think he was there. I mean, he was performing the songs, but he could have been performing them anywhere. You had no feel. He had no feel for where he was, I felt like. And so, you know, those are some of the things that I would judge people on. And I think that's the only way you can be fair to people. You know, you don't have to love their music, but if you can appreciate what they do and the work that they put into it, then you can at least give them, you know, the review that they deserve.
Did you find yourself paying attention to particular parts of the concert? Like, you know, if the drummer was particularly good or the guitarist or if it's just the singer blows you away. I mean, do you focus on one part of it because this person, I mean, obviously I would have to say, for example, you know,
Aerosmith is a good example of that. I mean, you're paying attention to Steven Tyler, you're paying attention to Joe Perry, and then you got three guys who are standing there like, you know, a pigeon could land on them and they wouldn't move, you know? I mean, so you're not paying attention. And those guys are very good at what they do, but, you know, I mean, Steven Tyler is what you're paying attention to. Joe Perry is what you're paying attention to.
Do you find yourself a big Stones fan?
I'm a big Stones fan.
Are you, you want to weigh in on the Stones, Beatles?
I'm more of a Stones guy than a Beatles guy because the Stones are dirtier. And I don't know. I don't know any other way to put it than that. I mean, I love both of them, but if I had my druthers, you know, I'd be listening to Beggar's Banquet. So
as opposed to Abbey Road,
The second side of Abbey Road, I think is just absolute genius. I mean, you know, I listen to that quite often.
Who were the musicians that you saw, whether it's reviewing or in person, who just really are like, where the talent is so overwhelming? You and I have been to a few concerts together, not many, but a few, where you just look at them and go, it's incredible that you could be so damn good at what you do as X is.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of them. Let me think, the first person that comes to mind is like Steve Vai, where you watch
the guitar player
and you just go, how do you do that? You know, how does anybody learn to do that and to invent it in certain ways? I mean, Eddie Van Halen, I know you always think that I was hypercritical of Van Halen and probably was, but But
I never thought you were critical of Eddie Van Halen.
No, I was certainly not critical of Eddie Van Halen. I mean, you know, you just watch that and go, geez, how do you do that? I mean, Jimmy Page, people like that. You just,
I remember being overawed by Geddy Lee. Mm-hmm. I had really good seats to a Rush concert 20 feet away from Geddy Lee one time. And he's playing the bass pedals and he's playing the keyboards and he's singing. And then he goes into a solo on his actual bass guitar. Then goes right back to what he was doing before. It's just, it's a phenomenal amount of talent. You saw John Bonham live.
Yes.
Do you remember that? What it was? Because he was this, I guess, along with Moon, but I think Bonham is regarded as the uber drummer of rock and roll.
Yeah, I mean, because nobody can do what Bonham does. Although, did you see that video of that 8-year-old girl
yes.
playing Bonham? Mm-hmm. I mean, Good Times, Bad Times. Mm-hmm. That's hilarious. It's just great. But, you know, Bonham was amazing. I mean, Bonham loved his snare drum, and he would just, you know, snare and hi-hat. He was all over that. But, you know, Keith Moon, that was certainly one of the most powerful exhibitions of drumming. I mean, you know, this side of Kenny Aronoff and stuff. There are a lot of really great musicians, and it was, I grew up in the right time. I mean, I got to see them.
So, well, we saw Stanley Clark and Al DiMeola together.
Oh, that's right.
You're just
right.
Like, yeah. These yes. guys don't even look like they're trying, and it's beyond comprehension sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, you look at that and you go, poor Lenny White. And Lenny White's like so amazing. And he's like the fourth best musician on the stage. And you just, I mean, I saw Carl Palmer from Emerson, Lake and Palmer play at the Noodle.
That's
yes.
right.
And to see Carl Palmer in that little room,
drummer.
I mean, it's scary how strong he is and how powerful he's drumming. And I'm watching him, and he's got a young guitar player and a young bass player, and they were all both really phenomenal players. And I'm thinking, you know, that poor bass player, he's the third best player on this stage. How terrible, what does that feel like?
Whose voice, I've been actually listening to a lot of Zeppelin lately, and there's some songs where Plant just sounds, I hate to say angelic, I think very few people could go from, you know, demon to angel like he could, and back and forth, especially songs like 10 Years Gone and others like that. But whose voice in rock and roll specifically did you just be like, you just got to be kidding me? What an absolutely beautiful voice, especially to hear it in that genre.
Well, I don't know if beautiful is the word, but Paul Rodgers, you know, Bad Company, and mm-hmm. or not Bad Company, but Free. And
Bad Company.
And Bad Company, that's mm-hmm. right, yeah. I mean, I always thought, boy, he could just, they came right up from the cojones, mm-hmm. you know, right? into his throat. That was, he's got an amazing, amazing voice. You know, Plant's voice is a delicate instrument, and sometimes live was not what it, you know, what it should be. You know, and that happens to everybody, I guess, you know. It's very rare that you can be, you know, in your 60s and such, and still hitting the high notes.
Sure. Elton John specific. I mean, he just talked about it. Like, there's certain songs I can't play anymore because I'm not going to be playing Benny and the Jets like it's 1978 anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
what about, let me throw another name out there, because I actually was listening to music yesterday. Ann Wilson from Heart.
Yeah. Never been a big fan
of Heart or her
either. But yeah, I mean, she can sing. I mean,
Pat Benatar.
Never was a fan, and I'm not I don't know if I saw her live. I mean, it's not ringing a bell.
What would be the most surprising band on your iPod where people would be like, I didn't see that coming? I'll confess, mine would be DeBarge. I'm a huge DeBarge fan. They have a phenomenal bass player, and unlike today's horrid rap music or whatever you want to call it, that's just atrocious, where they just have abandoned all instruments, that makes you go back to Earth, Wind, and Fire and Kool and the Gang and stuff like that, where they actually played the guitar, they played these instruments, and they had these terrific
and they were great,
terrific musicians. I'm trying to think of the guy who played for Sting for a while, a black guy, the guitarist, played the solo on Sting's version of Little Wing that was just absolutely beautiful. But
it's not Greg Fillengain's.
No, and I'll think of it here in a second, but it's that sort of, but DeBarge and Earth, Wind & Fire and Cool and the Gang, kind of, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, you know, that's the music that people would be like, we just went from Rush and War Pigs to Who's Holding Donna Now? Who would it be for you?
Who would it be? I mean, I should tell you, I never had an iPod, and I don't have any music on my phone. I still listen.
You don't?
I don't. I still listen to CDs when I'm listening.
Well, I've driven. I've ridden past you on bikes before. Are you just not listening to anything?
I know. I don't listen to anything. No. I just, when I'm riding my bike, I'm just thinking of, you know, not crashing into anybody or anything. But you know, I who
if we're at your house, if the millions of people listening right now. And we're here with Mark Allen, former music critic, TV critic for the Annapolis Star, now works at Butler University. If we're at your house for a party and you put something on, that what would make the crowd go, oh my, that's a knuckleball?
When people come over, I usually try to put on something pretty general that people would like. And I think so. I probably put on the Beatles or the Stones or the Beach Boys or something.
Beach Boys fan?
No, not really. But I feel like
you're a good host.
But yeah, I feel like, you know, everybody sort of likes the Beach Boys, and so why not?
Did you mentioned writing critical pieces, yeah, critical reviews? Safe to say that you heard from these artists about your review, or do they just like, I'm making millions and I've got 10 girls in my room and I don't care what Mark Allen thinks?
Yeah, I heard from a bunch of them, and it was sort of like I had this very Forrest Gump existence, you know, as a critic, where I would just go, how am I in the middle of this? Why do you care what I think? You know, you want a story?
Yes, I said the listeners of Leaders and Legends want a story from you because you've interacted with some of these folks. And quite frankly, I would be surprised if a David Lee Roth or a Ozzy Osbourne would get that upset about a review from Indianapolis. But you've told me before that these stars have gotten upset.
Yeah, I mean, the story I always tell is about Phil Collins. So Phil Collins played with Genesis in at the then, I'm not sure if it was the RCA Dome at that point. Might have been. It was the Hoosier Dome.
And you're a huge
Dome.
Genesis fan.
I'm a huge Genesis fan. So they played at the Dome, and it was 1992, and I gave it a extremely critical review. I thought it was an awful show, and
great songs, and or they just mailed it in.
I thought they mailed it in, and I thought it was a fairly terrible selection of material. But so the next day I'm sitting at my desk at the paper and the phone rings. I answer, Mark Allen, and I hear at the end, Mark Allen, Phil Collins. And I said, hi, Phil, because Phil calls every day, you know, it's no big deal. And he said, am I allowed to use profanity on this show?
If it's pertinent.
Yes, and, it is pertinent.
And accurate historically.
It is both. So he said, I just want to tell you that your review was the biggest pile of shit I've ever read. And then he went on for a few minutes to say things about me and about the review. And so I listened to him for a bit, and then I said, well, I'm sorry you felt that way because I am a big Genesis fan. I own virtually every record you've ever made, which was the truth. And I've seen every tour you've done since 1975. This was 1992 now. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to hear that, right? They want to hear, I hate you, and and that's why I wrote the negative review, right? So we had some argument about the review. Like, the second song they played was No Son of Mine, which was on the album that We Can't Dance. And
hardly their best effort.
Yes. And I said, and I criticized him in the review for sitting on the drum riser and singing during that song. And he said, I was acting. And I said, there's nothing in the lyric that would suggest sitting down and singing that song. Now, you know, if you want to sit down, he's got that song, you know, sit down, sit mm-hmm. down, is right. Sit down during that song. Don't sit down during the second song of the show. So we went around for a while. He said, at the end, and we were probably on the phone 5 to 10 minutes. He said, "Well, I got to go. I got another pile of shit to do in Columbus tonight." And I said, "Well, I hope you come back, and I hope I can give you a good review." So that's 1992. 1994, and to preface this, you have to remember there's no real internet or not much internet. So I get a call from a friend of mine who lives in California who I talk to a couple of times a year. And he said, "Did you give Genesis a bad review?" And I said, "Yeah, how'd you know that?" And he said, "Because Phil Collins was on The Tonight Show talking about it." And I said, "You're kidding." And he was. And you can look it up on YouTube, and it's great. And he talks about the conversation that we had. Anyway, so my friend said, you know, he hears this. He says, "I'm laying in bed. I'm listening to Phil Collins or watching Phil Collins on there. And he's talking about this guy in Indianapolis." And I said, "It's got to be Mark." So, you know, so that was me. So there was that. Then 1997, Phil Collins is going to come back here as a solo artist, and he's going to play at Market Square Arena. So his publicist called and said, "Phil, would you like to talk to Phil?" And I said, "I'd love to talk to Phil. I can't believe he wants to talk to me, but okay." So I'm sitting at home. It's scheduled. It's on a Saturday. Phone rings. I answer the phone. Mark Allen. He goes, "Mark Allen, Phil Collins." I said, "You didn't call to yell at me again, did you?" And he goes, "Oh, that's right." He said, "I'm sorry about that." And I said, "You have nothing to be sorry for." I said, "First of all, it's amazing to me that you care, you know?"
Yeah, that would be my point.
It was phenomenal that he cared. And I love Phil Collins, and Phil Collins is an amazing talent, okay? But the fact that he cared about the negative review, I always thought was amazing. So I said, "You have nothing to apologize for. I love that you called." And I said, "And second, I have a story I'm going to tell for the rest of my life." And here it is. It's 2019, 27 years later, and I'm still telling this story.
Did the conversation go okay?
Yeah, the interview was great.
And, how was his performance that night?
It got canceled. Out of fear.
HL Mencken-esque.
They said that it was a routing problem, which is usually a euphemism for we didn't sell enough tickets. But whatever it was, you know, whatever reason, he didn't come back, and he has not come back. And I think he's coming back on this unretired tour.
But, oh, really?
Yeah, but I'm not sure.
Was that the most difficult? You know, we talked to Bill Benner a little bit. We talked to Jim Shella kind of about this in previous podcasts. And we're here with Mark Allen, longtime music and TV critic for Indianapolis Star, who currently works at Butler University, where Benner had to write a column that criticized someone he liked, or Shella had to stick a microphone in the face of someone he liked, including the host of Leaders and Legends, brought to you by Veteran Strategies, and ask them really tough questions. And so when you go see a band and you're a huge fan of the band, to the example we just heard about Genesis, is it harder to fry them? Or is it like, damn it, despite the fact that I get paid to come here, I was really looking forward to just listening to this, and you guys just didn't measure up?
I take it more personally. Because I care. I have a relationship with this band. Mm-hmm. You know, if I don't care about the band, then, you know, I can, it's much easier to criticize. You know, it was much easier to review Bon Jovi than it is to review a band that I like.
If you had to choose one Bon Jovi song to listen to the rest of your life, because that's your sentence, which would you choose?
Kill Me Now. No such song exists.
Not even One of Dead or Alive, no. Which is kind of the song that everybody holds on to if you have to listen to Bon Jovi.
Nothing.
The guitarist on the Sting song cover of Little Wing is Hiram Bullock.
Oh, Hiram Bullock, who played in Letterman's band.
Phenomenal guitar player. If you haven't heard Sting's version of Little Wing, it's on the Nothing Like the Sun album, I believe. It is a incredibly beautiful cover of Hendrix's song Little Wing. Mm-hmm. When you go to a concert, how much does their popularity affect you, or do you just not care?
I don't care. I never cared.
So if you wrote a scathing review about Poison when they're in their prime, or if they ever had
which
a prime,
I probably did.
In it, you, do you know, like I used to, the late, great Matt Tully, whom we love, when he'd write about guns in his column, I'd send him a text and I would just go, you feeling masochistic today? Or, and he would write back, he'd always write back with something funny and witty, like, yeah, I hadn't been yelled at in a while, so I thought I'd write about the Second Amendment. But when you're writing about a popular band and for whatever reason, you write a really tough review, do you just know that it's coming? Or did you think the stars that you didn't live in the age of the internet where they could just email you their column?
I'm really happy about that. You know, I mean, email was just, I did that job from 1990 to 1998. So email was relatively new. I mean, people had it, but, you know, not everybody had it. And your review couldn't go viral quite as much. In fact, I wrote this, the single most negative review I ever wrote was a Fish, and I like Fish, but this show was so terrible. I mean, just uniformly terrible. Every song was the same plodding, awful jam. It was just, it was terrible. And I wrote this review where I said, you know, to paraphrase Judge Judy, Judge Judy would always say, don't pee on my leg and tell me it's raining. Mm-hmm. I'd say, you know, Fish, you could pee in their fans' ears and tell them it's music. And they would turn on their tape recorders so that they could capture the moment. And so, I wrote that review and there are a couple of things happened. One is because there was no internet really to move it around so much, fans would pass it along. And so like every month I would get a letter from an angry Fish fan. And that happened for a year. You know, it's really not like it is today where if Dave Lindquist, you know, who's been doing this job for 20 years now, writes a negative review, they're going to pile on him. You know, it wasn't like that. It was like, it would be trickling in. And the funny part about that one, that review too, is there's a documentary called Bittersweet Motel about Fish where Fish reads my review. and I, you know, I give all the credit in the world to Trey Anastasio, the guitar player. He said he read it and he went to that particular line and he said, well, you know, he's right. Sometimes, you know, if you're going to take chances on stage, sometimes you're going to fail. And I thought, wow, that's a really, really thoughtful approach.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, Larry Bird had bad shooting nights and, you know, the world's best goaltender gives up five goals. I mean, sometimes you fail. I mean, especially if you see a band either multiple times in one tour or multiple times over the years, you notice like, okay, they don't move around like they used to, or, you know, a lot of the songs that they used to play, they don't play anymore either because they can't or, but you're talking about bands from our era, you're 10 years older than I am that, I mean, people complain, for example, you mentioned Van Halen, they aren't doing anything. They're all in their 60s. Like, what are they supposed to be doing? I mean, Bill Wyman's retired, but a lot of these guys that are still playing from Moody Blues or, I mean, the Who's coming to town. How old's Pete Townsend?
Yeah, he's got to be in his 70s.
Has to be, close to it. Name a group, because I want to ask you about one other musician encounter before we move on. Can you think of a group that surprised you? Like, I'm going to go review this, because you didn't really review albums per se. Is that correct? Sometimes. But a lot of it, mostly concerts.
Yeah, mostly concerts.
Where you went there to go, oh my God, I guess I'll get this over with. And then you left going, okay, now that was surprisingly good.
One of the last concerts I covered was Motley Crue.
Yay.
And I knew it was time to go. I mean, because I couldn't tell. I thought it was good. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't tell. You know, I was
just post Vince Neil?
No.
Or had he come back?
This was pretty much the end of the early end of Motley Crue and you know, and there were bands that you know, I was not a Pantera fan. I couldn't get through a CD of Pantera, but I just thought that show, man, that was powerful. And, you know, there were a lot of nights like that where just bands surprise you with what they could do or, you know, how they could relate to their fans on stage.
Do you have another star encounter? Maybe one where he, who happened to be from Indiana, was somewhat threatening or unhappy?
Well, you know, John Mellencamp and I had some moments, and
again, surprised that they care. Like,
yeah, well, you're a millionaire rock star. John, you could understand because this was his hometown paper, sure. and stuff. And John, he said to me, he said, you know, I'll go on tour and I'll get. You know, I'll get 70 or 80 reviews and three of them are negative and yours is always one of them. And it's like, well, I'm not sure that's true, but.
Did you like him as an artist generally?
I wasn't a huge fan, and I'm, although ironically, he played a couple of, I guess it was in December in Bloomington. He did a benefit and I went to see him and I thought he was real good. And I always thought he put on a good show. I mean, there were very
terrific
few.
Band.
Oh God. Great.
Terrific band.
Band.
Yeah. And I think in Indiana, he got it. I don't know how many times I've seen him, half dozen maybe, which, and yeah. There's probably people who've seen him 50 times, but that yeah. Every time I was like, he knows what the crowd wants to hear, especially here in Indiana. And he plays those songs and he plays them with energy.
Yeah. He always did that. And he tried to work in songs that he wanted to play. And he realized that was a losing battle a lot of times, you know? And so he would cut those songs, stuff. But I mean, I go back with John Mellencamp. I met John Mellencamp when I was in college. So it was about 1978. Really? And he was coming through it was in Boston, and I knew his manager, and his manager said, hey, come and meet this guy. So I listened to the record and I thought,
which one, Nothing Mattered? Or,
I'm not sure which one it was.
Or just the John Cougar.
It was a record where I said, ugh. And, anyway, but I went and I met him, and he was so funny and so engaging and really interesting. And he told this great story about going to Phil Spector's house because they wanted Phil Spector to produce him.
Sure.
And I just thought, oh, this is such an interesting guy. It's too bad I'm never going to hear of him again. Because I just figured this record's so bad, I'm, you know, it's
really,
yeah, he's mm-hmm. not going anywhere, and shows you what I know. So
Scarecrow,
was way before that.
Yeah, but is probably my favorite of the Mellencamp. I think he really started to get his sound there. The drumming was so powerful; it really kind of carries almost all of his albums.
Kenny's just, you know, he's a force of nature, and there's a guy in his 60s, and you know,
does he play for the Who now?
No.
Who did he play for? He went to go play for someone else, and I forget who it was.
Yeah, you'll find him.
Super popular, though.
You'll find him with, I've seen him with Smashing Pumpkins, with John Fogerty, Melissa Etheridge. You know, he's out there. He just, you know.
I was actually, when I was mentioning someone with a Hoosier connection, and maybe you can't tell this story, but maybe you can only tell it at Binkley's. Mr. Rose.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you look at, if you Google letters of note and Axl Rose, you'll find a letter that Axl wrote to me. It was after the Metallica Guns N' Roses Faith No More show at the Dome. And basically I said, you know, Metallica kind of ate Guns N' Roses lunch. And Axel was not happy with that. And so I'm sitting in the office, and I can't remember if it was the next day or the day after that, but a fax comes in from Axel, and you can see it on letters of note. And it's really funny. And I just, you know, that's
in your reply. That's
did I reply? I did reply.
No, I know your reply. I'm asking you to share your reply.
I replied and I said, what did I say to him? I think I said, do you remember what I said to him? I can't.
Some sort of record.
Yeah.
Police.
I that's right. I sent him back a copy of his police record from when he was a kid. He didn't
New
respond
York,
to
New
that.
New York Justice.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You know, I mean, look at, you know, I'm not a big guy. I'm not a physical person. If somebody was going to fight me, they were going to win. But I feel like I can hold my own in an argument. You know? And that comes from growing up in New York, because everything is an argument where I come from.
If you had to, as we wind up here before our notorious and infamous five questions segment, put your rock band together. Keyboardist, drummer, singer, bassist, guitarist. If you could put your super group together from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, so your era, or 90s, when you're a critic for the Star.
Well, none of them would go together. I mean, they just wouldn't make
matter.
Any sense.
It's just it's an all-star team.
Well, okay. Well, I mean, Smokey Robinson is my favorite vocalist. So
of
I
all
think,
time?
Yeah. I think that's a voice. You know, if I used to work with a guy and he had this running list and he would ask everybody, he would say, the bad news is your voice is gone. The good news is we can replace it with anybody's voice. Who would you replace it with? And to me, it was like Smokey, you know, I want to sing like that. You know,
as ABC wrote,
that's right. When Smokey sings, mm-hmm. I hear violins, well. guitar player. You know, there are greater guitar players, but you know, I grew up an enormous Yes fan. And so Steve Howe is probably my guitar player. I mean, there are definitely better players. I mean, Zappa would mm-hmm. probably be my other one. Wouldn't you like to hear Zappa with Smokey Robinson?
Zappa probably would have been down with it.
Actually, it would have been all
right. His son's a phenomenal guitar player.
Yes, that's right. His son is a phenomenal guitar
player. Steve Howe, probably, there are probably people who were faster, but I don't know that there was a guitarist who made fewer mistakes. He just seemed like he could. I mean, to your point about Steve Vai earlier, you just stare at his fingers and you're like, how can you be that precise and that fast every single time you play these songs so effortlessly?
Yeah. Okay. So
are you going to choose a bassist from the same band?
Well, probably, because Chris Squire. I mean, I picked up the bass because I was so enamored with what Chris Squire did. And then I put down the bass because I could not do that. I mean, how did he do that? You know, it was just incredible. Him or Entwistle. John Entwistle from The Who would be there. And drummers, my all-time favorite drummer is Dennis Dyke from The Smithereens. There's never been a drummer, I think. I mean, there are, again, better drummers, probably, but there's never been a drummer who works in service of the song better than Dennis. If you watch him, there's no show to the guy. I sat behind him once at a concert, and the sticks, you barely ever saw the sticks come up above his shoulders. He is playing. There's no showboating. The guy is just the most phenomenal drummer. I love the way he plays. If I could do anything as good as he plays drums, I would be really happy.
Never heard of him, which just probably puts me in a bad category.
Well, look at this. Go listen to the Smithereens.
I mean, I've heard of the Smithereens, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, just watch him play. It's
keyboardist?
Extraordinary. And keyboardist, geez, do I go back to Rick Wakeman?
I was just going to say, you want to just complete your...
Keith Emerson, I guess. You know, I mean, I just always thought he, you know, there was no better showman than Keith Emerson.
When MTV came around, as we wind up, good for music, bad for music? I mean, it's a staple of when I grew up, obviously, in the 80s. But, I mean, when it came around, were you like, wow, we can see these bands now? Because, you know... No YouTube, no MTV. You never saw these people play unless they went on, you know, Midnight Special or some sort of talk show.
I remember, you know, because videos weren't that, I mean, you never saw videos before, really. And I remember in about 1979, Blondie did a video I can't remember which album it was. But I think they did a video, and they did videos for all the songs. And being the great mind that I am, having the ability to see into the future, and we were also going through an energy crisis, and I was thinking, well, this will be, you know, like, this is what people will do. They won't go on tour anymore. They'll just release videos. So it shows you how what I know.
They did both.
They did both, but... You know, so MTV came along and I was just remember being mesmerized by that. You know, it's like it wasn't just the, you know, it was like the chance to see the bands, but also to see video techniques. I mean, that were some extraordinary things. So
The first computer animation that people saw was in those videos.
Yeah.
Dire Straits, Money for Nothing. But you didn't really see that out there too much until, and they were highly expensive.
No, I mean, and the only place I had seen anything, you know, I mean, like Pink Floyd, the first Pink Floyd concert I saw was 1975. And, you know, they had animation that was light years ahead of what anybody else was doing. But you'd see them, you know, so I just thought, this is the way it's going to be. But I remember my sisters and I would sit in front of the TV and just watch MTV. And we were just like, you couldn't turn it off.
And I've told my kids that. I'm like, you go home from school and you turned on MTV and you watched it all night, or it was playing in the background all night. And yeah, you were talking on the phone to your friend while he or she was watching it all night. It was a cultural phenomenon, probably without parallel, I would say, until the internet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very quickly, most overrated band of all time. Overrated, like everyone loves them and they're terrible.
Well,
according to Mark Allen,
not terrible, but I've never been a U2 fan, and I've never been a Tom Petty fan, and so I think it's a tie. I mean, it's not that they're terrible; they're both really good bands. They just never did it for me.
It was interesting on YouTube. If you Google Pete Townsend, Led Zeppelin, there's a 45-second clip where Pete Townsend says, I don't like anything about them. I don't like any of their songs. I don't like any of their albums. He goes, I like them all personally. He goes, maybe it's just because they were bigger than we are, but I just never liked anything they've done. And you sit there and go, like, you don't like, like, you can't pick, like, Trampled Underfoot or Visible Graffiti or.
I mean, that's surprising to me. I know people who don't like Led Zeppelin for a variety of reasons, including, you know, that they took a lot of old blues songs and you know, kind of made them, and they didn't even make them their own. They just appropriated them, let's say. But no, I mean, U2, I saw U2 when they played, it was at the Conseco, maybe, mm-hmm. when it was Conseco Fieldhouse. And I thought, this is a band that radio has done exactly right. Every song that they played that was a radio hit, that was a pretty good song. And every song they played that was a deep cut, nothing. You know, just did not hear anything in that. And Petty, you know,
phenomenal songwriter.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote some really good songs, and he wrote a lot of stuff that, you know, I mean, I saw him live sometimes where he was really good, and sometimes where last time he played here, I walked out. So it was
as a critic or as a fan?
As a fan. I didn't go as a fan. The Smithereens were opening up, and I wanted to see the Smithereens, and I stayed as long as I could stand, which was about an hour.
Most underrated. Like, this band doesn't get the credit it deserves, either because of talent or impact or. I always thought the Kinks were kind of underrated. Yeah. Like, they were phenomenally seminal band in the 60s. Obviously Van Halen's cover of You Really Got Me is what a lot of people know.
Yeah.
Kind of by association, but they seem like they kind of get lost a little bit.
Yeah, the Kinks are a good choice because nobody really pays attention, but, you know, on the other hand, I mean, and the Kinks were a good live band too. I saw them a few times. You know, there are so many underrated bands that you just don't, you know, that you wouldn't know because they never made it, you know. So there's there was a band called Uncle Green Uncle Green and I just loved that band, and I thought they were some of the great, you know, they wrote some of the best, catchiest, poppiest songs, and nobody ever heard of them. They never got anywhere. So that's the one that comes to mind, but I'm sure I could go through, you know, my collection and find you a lot of bands that no one's ever heard of.
We've reached the five questions segment of Leaders and Legends presented by Veteran Strategies. We're here with Mark Allen, longtime journalist in the Indianapolis area. We end all the podcasts with the same five questions.
Okay.
So what was your first car that you bought?
That I bought. It was a Chevy Citation. I think that was
quite the chick magnet car.
Oh yeah. But you know, it was. I think it was $6,300. So that was, and it was 1980, and that was what I could afford.
That sounds about right.
Yep.
Speaking of the energy crisis you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to ask this question of you because it's been so much a part of what
we... I am not a car guy, by the way. I mean, I just... A car is transportation and transportation.
Leaders and Legends, we're not judgmental.
Okay, thank you.
We don't judge. Good. But actually, the second question in our five questions is particularly apropos. What was your first concert?
A group called Deodato, D-E-O-D-A-T-O. And that was a guy's name. And at the time, they had a hit with a synthesizer version of the theme to the 2001 A Space Oddity, and that was Odyssey, and that was a radio hit, and I was 14 years old, so we went.
That'll be hard to top for obscurity.
Yeah, but interestingly, on that bill was Freddie Hubbard. He was one of the opening acts. So it's weird, my connections to Indianapolis, you know, like Freddie Hubbard from Indianapolis was I think the third on that bill. There were like, it was Stanley Turrentine, Eric Gale, Freddie Hubbard, and Deodato. And so that was like my Indianapolis connection. And then, you know, I was a huge Letterman fan. And so,
sure.
And so long before I was in Indianapolis, I was connecting with Indianapolis.
And I imagine, and we didn't get a chance to talk about how much Indianapolis has changed just since you got here.
Yeah, it's crazy.
If you could recommend one book to anyone to read, which book?
My favorite book is The Boys on the Bus by Tim Krause. Yeah. And it's about the press corps covering the 1972 presidential campaign. And it's part of the reason that I wanted to be a reporter. I read that book and I'm just like, I want to be one of these guys.
Well, it was certainly a book that portrayed the lighter side of being a reporter.
Yeah, yeah. But I learned a lot about journalism.
Humanized them would be the word, maybe.
Yeah, and explain them why they thought that the way they did and why they acted the way they did and why they wrote the way they did.
What if you could witness any event in history, be there when it happened, which event would you choose? If you want to confine it just to music, we could live with that. But if you wanted to go back a little further?
Well, you know, my first thought is I would have loved to have seen a Beatles concert. That would have been nice. But anything in history? Wow. You know, do I get to come back or do I have to live there?
No, you just get to witness it.
Yeah, I'd like to see what it was like when Christ was around. You know, I'm not a religious person, but I just think...
Sermon on the Mount, know, perhaps?
That'd be fine. You know, but
you could live with that.
I could, sure. And do you have the power to send me there, Mr. Vane?
It's possible under the new regime. It's possible. And if you could have dinner with anyone in the world right now, tonight, who would you choose?
So it's somebody who's alive?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, then I think I would like to have dinner with Paul McCartney, and not because I'm a huge Beatles fan or because he's my favorite or anything like that, but you watch that guy and he radiates joy. And I just wonder about that. What's that like to be where everybody who's around you is happy? They're happy to be in your presence.
And there's millions of people listening to your music right now who are happy.
Yeah, but I mean, you watch, if did you see that James Corden thing mm-hmm. that he did? How can you not be happy? How can you not watch that and go, this is the greatest thing ever? This guy, everywhere he goes, he makes people happy. And I'd like to bask in that for an hour.
Certainly one of the five most famous people in the world, would you think?
Yeah, I would guess so. I mean, I don't know that physically people would recognize him now as much because, you know, he's mm-hmm. older, but I mean, he looks substantially the same. But, you know, and if he was walking down the street, I don't know if you'd notice necessarily, but yeah, I would guess he's probably is.
We are thrilled to have you. Thank you for making time.
Yeah.
Lots, we discussed a lot, but we actually left out a little bit. So maybe we can have you back once this hits the worldwide web and we start to have more conversations. There were lots of questions I didn't get to ask you. Stay away from politics for the benefit of everybody. And but you are, and always have been since I've met you, a terrific, terrific, very generous, very kind friend, Mark. And we appreciate you being on Leaders and Legends today.
Thanks. It was great. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you very much for listening to Leaders and Legends, brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated. If you want to contact us about this program or our menu of public relations services, please send us an email at robert@veteranstrategies.com. That's Robert@veteranstrategies.com.